So it all started kind of little, you know, step by step. You know, was I remember having this kind of goal of having a group of, you know, 5, 10 companies that would support the whole idea of this collaboration community. And now we have, you know, some amazing brands from McDonald's to Intercontinental Hotels to Compass, EasyJet, Virgin Atlantic, Pizza Express, Pizza Hut, Nando's, you know, just all the kind of the restaurant chains that we are all familiar with. And we have an incredible reach. We reach 2.1 million employees with the companies are involved in the collaboration community that we have created under WHTL. So the goal is to get to 5 million by 2025 globally. And I'm speaking to a number of very, very large employers that will allow me to get a bit closer to that goal. Hopefully, fingers crossed, still this year we will make a big step up in that direction. And what is the kind of if you like, I mean, there is no secret because I shout and share and talk about this to whoever wants to listen. Even if they don't want to listen, I talk about this all the time because I'm absolutely passionate about it. But it's all about collaboration. So it's all about joining forces. I am a strong believer that no single company can make a big difference on their own.
Tia Colajanni has never been shy about setting audacious goals. As a child growing up in Italy, she decided to become the Italian ambassador to Singapore. And though her career took her to Brussels as a lawyer focusing on European employment law, and to later serving as human resources executive at companies like Hilton Hotels Worldwide and Merlin Entertainments, which operates Legoland, Madame Tussauds, and the London Eye, she's always been about impact. And as founder of WIHTL, Women in Hospitality, Tourism, and Leisure, she has set a goal of positively impacting 5 million people by 2025. In this episode of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, she describes the journey to get there.
So welcome to this week's show of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and myself. And I'm delighted to welcome Tia Coiani. She, by definition of how I've described it, is a Italian from southern Italy. And some experiences that she'll describe throughout the show that you'll never forget. And you'll pick up on a lot of her leadership skills and learnings for all of us. What was remarkable when I spoke to her originally and I looked at her CV of experience, it was a dartboard. It was a plethora of major blue chip companies. It was a plethora of solid academic experience. And, you know, she started studying law, and there's a story behind that we'll find out now in a moment. Went on to the bar, went on to become a lawyer, and then various other roles, which I won't spoil for now, has led her to the strong, sort of powerful position of moving out of blue chip companies, such as the VP of Hilton Worldwide, looking after HR, to more recently, I guess, you know, moving into what we call, you know, from earn and learn to return. So working as an NED to various companies. And she is now one of the senior NEDs of Watches of Switzerland. But linked into that, another story which I felt was so powerful, and it'll come out in this interview, is her passion and her desire to help people, and in particular, women and people of a diversity. And she has a big goal. Yeah, she's putting down, and it's written here, and I'd love you to read up on her later. She's putting down to help and support 5 million women around the world by 2025. She's already talked to me about how she's achieving that. Alongside that, a charming lady. And I think with that charm and that work ethic and collaboration, she has been a successful icon for all women across the world. So welcome, Tia, to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me.
No, it's a pleasure. And I guess let's just start and share this experience, because fundamentally, somebody going into law and starting through a really solid process, you know, is quite exceptional, and not everybody does it. Tell us a little bit about the background to, I guess, you, your family, and how you moved into that direction.
Sure. It was never my intention to become a lawyer. There wasn't the plan. When, as a little girl, people asked me what I wanted to do as a grown up, I used to say that I wanted to work in airlines and I wanted to be an air stewardess. And I remember saying that to my dad, and in answer to a question that his boss asked me. And my dad didn't say anything there and then, but afterwards, in private, he said, are you really sure that that's what you want to do? And I said, yes, you know, I can travel around the world, I can go and see places, you know, just it's going to be so exciting, it's so glamorous, I want to work for Alitalia. And then my father said, do you realize that when, on a plane, you need to push a trolley and serve drinks and food to the customers? And then do you realize that when somebody is poorly, you've got to clean up the mess that they have left behind? And that suddenly didn't sound very glamorous at all. So I thought I should come up with something else. And I came up with, I wanted to be the Italian ambassador to Singapore. Don't ask me why Singapore. It just sounded far away and exotic and mysterious and wonderful. And my father was really happy. You know, he informed his boss that I wanted to be the Italian ambassador to Singapore. So I got the approval from my father and his boss. So when it came to putting forward my application for university, I had done my research. I wanted to study political sciences because that was the path that would lead me to become an ambassador. And the night before I was supposed to go to the university office and submit my application, my brother, who's 5 years older than me, he was studying law at the time. He approached me, and up until that moment, he had never even acknowledged my existence. as a kind of your older brother sometimes can do. He said to me, what if? What if it doesn't work out? What if you are not able to become the Italian ambassador to Singapore? What will you do? I didn't have a plan B. And he suggested that I should study law instead because that would give me many more options. I could still pursue that type of career if I wanted to after 4 years of university. But also if it didn't work out, because in Italy at the time, it was only people from certain families with, two surnames and certain background that would have access to that type of career. So if I didn't succeed, I could do many, many more things. And gosh, I thank him every day. I actually reminded him a few years ago about this story. He just couldn't remember. Anyway, I went to my dad the night before with my new forms and I said to my dad, I wanted to study law. And I can just picture the image as if it was yesterday. You know, he was in bed reading his newspaper and I went and I said, Dad, I've decided I want to study law. And he put the newspaper down and he said, I don't think that's a good idea. And I said, yes. And I explained the whole thing again and just said, this is going to be, just such a great opportunity for me. And then he said, that's not right for a woman. You need to do something a bit, easier. You're going to have a family and children. What's this idea of traveling the world and just going to different places and just do something a little bit easier? And I looked at my mom, who was next to him, and said, come on, just I gave her the eye, and just step in. And she said, perhaps we should let her decide and we should give her the chance to, do that. So my father picked up the newspaper again and said, okay, then. So that's my story. That's why I studied law, never wanting to be a lawyer. But then that's where life took me because after university, I won a scholarship in European law. And I ended up working in a law firm in Brussels. Wow.
So that's what I was going to ask you, because you kind of did it almost as I guess a bit of mentoring, from a somebody. You talk about a collaboration and mentoring being really strong. But then I was going to ask you about how you then got in from a first class honours and you moved on to this master's. But so was there a direction there as well? Were you still slipstreaming towards law, or were you considering other options?
So when I was at university studying law, I still had in mind all of this kind of, the international side of things. So all of the optional courses that I could choose, I chose the United Nations, I chose the European Union workings. I've even done a course on the agricultural policy of the European Union. So anything that would give on my CV kind of a strong kind of sense of this is my path, this is what I'm studying for, I'm preparing for that type of career. So it was obvious I had not completely abandoned my ambitions and aspirations. I didn't want to be a family lawyer. I didn't want to be doing litigation in court. And I was admitted to the bar because my father by then was, okay, you've studied law, so you've got to do the exams, the bar exams, and so that you can be called doctor and avvocato. So I did that to keep him happy. And but I also studied employment law, which was something which was particularly interesting for me. So after university, when I graduated, I by pure chance, and this is this is life. I remember it was a weekend. I was walking through the corridors of my university, and I saw a poster on a door that publicized the master in European law and economics in Perugia. And I went back the following day on the following Monday, and the poster had gone. And I remember like, oh gosh, where has it gone? And I just want to go for it. And so went to find the administrator who was in charge of that and had the poster in her drawer, got all the details, applied for a scholarship for that master, and won the scholarship. And so you can imagine me going back to my father to say, I've got a scholarship now and I'm leaving home. I'm going to go and study in Perugia, which he was by then very, very supportive, because he had kind of realized that I was on a path and I wasn't going to stop. And then it was actually as part of the master there was the opportunity to go abroad and for an internship. And again, I said, I want to go to Paris. That's where I want to do my internship. And they found me a place in Brussels, which was close enough. and I said, I don't want to go and work for a law firm. I want to go and work for a consultancy that works with the United Nations, some kind of international organizations. And guess what? They got me an internship in a law firm. So I couldn't escape. It was a fantastic opportunity. And obviously I accepted it and I ended up staying there for 4 years and making some fabulous friendships that I still cherish to this day.
That's fascinating. And tell me, because up until that stage of your career, I get the sense you're clever and ambitious. Yeah, you kind of go for it, which is fantastic. And we talk about the show, the What I Wish I Knew, and I think from what you're describing, it doesn't matter where you're from or what you are. If you want to go for something, then you've got to grasp it. I'm interested in that then, in this leap, if you like, or into the corporate world in some respects. So you talked about when you joined KPMG West, and it was quite a big role, wasn't it? Why did you do that? And what was different? What was your learning?
Sure. So I worked as a lawyer for 4 years, and I was quite lucky. It was a very international, multicultural organization with a lawyer from each one of the European Union countries. So it was incredibly diverse from a nationality and cultural and backgrounds perspective. And I was, you know, my passion, as I said, it became by then it was employment law. So I did everything that was, I mean, it was a very varied role. I did anything from telecommunications to anti-competition to fisheries policies. You know, it was incredibly diverse. But my area of expertise was employment law and employee relations. And I became the expert on everything to do with the European Works Councils. So I created, if you like, a little bit of a niche in the law firm, focusing on all of these multinational organizations. In particular, we had lots of American and Japanese clients who were really interested in what you have to do to create these European Works Councils, how do you keep the unions at bay, and all of that. So I did a lot of that, but then it became a little bit repetitive. It became a little bit, for me, it was the same advice, just to change the name of the company, change a few things here and there, but it was the same thing over and over and over. And there is a little bit kind of a character trait I had discovered by then, and looking back in my career, there is a point where when things get repetitive and get easy, I get bored, and that's the time for me to go and do something else and change. So that was the change for me. One of my clients said, you know, very good that you are advising us what to do. Why don't you come and do that in-house? And I thought, you know what? I'm actually quite tired of telling others what to do, advising what the best course of action is. Actually, what I want to be is in a position where I can be part of that decision-making process. So there was a kind of leap into in-house in the human resources department. It was an interesting, it was in telecommunications. And I really liked the people. It was a joint venture. It was a very diverse you know, group of people. It was Americans, it was French and Germans coming together. It didn't really work out, you know, in the end, because the differences were very, very stark between ways of leading and managing businesses. But it was an incredible experience. And then after that, the company was, I left. I was headhunted actually by another telecom companies in the UK. So that's when I moved to the UK. And to do a similar type of role, so I was in charge of employee relations. But there I did lots and lots of different things. It wasn't just employment law and employee relations. I moved more into kind of the broader HR side of things. I ended up being given the chance to, as part of the restructure of the company, become a VP of HR, responsible for a whole division. And then we were acquired by KPN Quest. And when KPN Quest bought us, everybody else left. They asked me to stay and become the SVP of HR of the two companies. And then guess what? The telecoms bubble burst and the whole company went into administration. So I always say I have seen the best of HR in the growth, expansion, go and buy businesses, integrating businesses. But I have also seen the worst of HR when it comes to letting people go, when it comes to the personal tragedies of people losing their jobs from one day to another, where there is no money to pay redundancies, where there is no money to pay for even pension contributions, where you don't know how you're going to pay the salaries at the end of the month. So there was a very, very tough period of time. I found myself in a position where I had to stand up in front of everybody in head office and welcome the receivers and hand over to them and just to say, I'm really sorry about what has happened. So there was a kind of, if you like, one of the, you know, incredible learning experience having to deal with all of that. So, certainly in terms of picking up the signs of when things are not right in a business, I've become quite well tuned into spotting those signs. Really, really tough at the time.
Talk a little bit about, you know, culture is such an important thing, you know, particularly in the roles that you had, and you know, and in leadership. And, you know, in your case, you were leading across cultures, you know, with, you know, multinational companies, but also, you know, companies have their own culture. So how do you see sort of the culture part of that equation in terms of what's to be learned, how to adjust to different cultures of people in different cultures of organizations?
So for me, it's always been, it's one of those things that you learn along the way. I've always wanted to be in an international environment, and actually I've always considered myself a European citizen, not just an Italian citizen. And now, you know, I'm also actually British citizen, but we won't get into the politics of that right now. But I've always considered myself, European. And I've always been lucky that all of my roles have been in very diverse environments. And I think, you know, if there is something I have learned, it's just never judge, listen, try to listen to the different points of view. They might not be the same as you. And I'm married to a Brit, so I know how, you know, cultural conflicts and cultural differences are still after 20 years. You know, I can see that the way we are brought up, the environments that we grow up in, the experiences that we have, you know, really shape us. And doesn't matter how long we live in another country, these things always come back and come out in the way we operate, in the way we talk, in the way we interact. So for me, it's about, you know, listening, it's trying to understand different people's perspectives, and finding ways of finding a kind of a common language, a common way of working. I have worked in Anglo-Saxon organizations primarily. So I've always worked with either American businesses or British businesses. I've had kind of spelled in when I was in Brussels with French and German, but primarily I've worked in Anglo-Saxon environments that were very international. So there was a kind of a large presence of people of a certain group. My Hilton role was incredibly diverse from a cultural perspective. And then you really saw how, I had a Swiss boss, and then I had a French boss, I had a German boss. And so you just get to learn different ways and different ways of operating, different ways of interacting, and try as much as it is possible not to take it personally. Sometimes you think it's you, sometimes you just actually, you realize it's not you, it's about how people see you and how, you are perceived. But I think, patience and tolerance, empathy and ability to listen are quite crucial when you operate in a multicultural environment.
And that's an interesting aspect there. You talk about this kind of, again, this IQ, but this EQ, that you bring to a role. What though, there must have been frustrations along the way, and things that concerned you, being so close, if you like, to the coalface of people and their livelihoods. What things did you pick up on through your early career? Obviously you're in the employment law here, but what things resonated with you in terms of moving on, thinking that this is something that's really affecting me and I want to work with this in the future?
Look, that's a very, very good question. I don't think I looked at things that way when I was younger. I just looked at interesting jobs, interesting roles, interesting people. I've always been very ambitious, and I know where that comes from. My dad always pushed me after the first resistance. Since then, he has always been incredibly supportive and incredibly proud, but also saying you always have to thrive and get for the best and do better. And so in my kind of early stages of my career, I looked at things, I wasn't really too concerned about society or in bad environments or being, you know, I was there to, you know, prove that I could go as far as my talent would let me go, and also make my father proud that he invested in me and he believed in me and he supported me. So I think that my concerns, if I can say concerns, have come more with age and maturity, and you get older and, you know, wiser, and you start seeing the impact of you know, what companies do and how companies operate. And in particular, I would say that kind of awareness has come to me in my last executive role, when I was a group HR director at Merlin Entertainments. You know, the company when I joined was in private equity hands. When I left, we had listed the business. We were a PLC. Wow. We went from being a FTSE 250 to a FTSE 100 in a matter of 6 months, very, very quickly. And with that comes a responsibility.
Yeah.
The company already had a strong sense of helping others and looking after others through the Merlin Magic Wand Foundation, the charity that the company had. Also, there was a sea life, you know, a charity as well, in terms of the sea creatures. And that's probably was the first time when I realized that there is more to a company than profit. There is more to a company than just, you know, achieving financial success. And if you like, I acquired, if you want, a moral and social conscience. And that's when, you know, there was a kind of my first spell into raising funds for charity, for Merlin's Magic Wand. I had never done anything like that before. I raised funds for the Prince's Trust.
Yep.
I had never done anything like that before. I discovered, actually, in addition to have kind of a social conscience, I was very good at, you know, asking for money. And if you like, you know, I had never been a salesperson, but me as a little girl watching my grandmother negotiating, she was in sales, and the family had, my grandmother's family had a shop, a kitchen, you know, utensils shop. And seeing how she negotiated, it all came back to me. And you just never know where you can get skills. And, you know, I credit her for my ability to negotiate and sell. And I did that, you know, in support of asking money for charity. Actually, it's not like selling, but, you know, it, still, you need to learn when a door shut in your face, when somebody doesn't get it. You don't take it personally, you move on to the next person, and you get better in terms of your sales pitch and why somebody should fund, you know, your project, initiative or cause or whatever, it might be.
Did the fact, and Merlin, as some people may not know, is major, major brands like a Legoland, Madame Tussauds, I think it's the London Eye.
Yeah.
Did that have, you know, you think of people who enjoy their brands, did that have a particular resonance with you? Did you, you talked about the things you did, you know, I guess we could say it's over and above, but maybe it's not, because you just felt it was the right thing to do. But did that have an influence on you at all?
Look, I've always loved working for, as I say, businesses that you can feel. Mm-hmm. That you can touch, you know, hospitality and leisure.
Yeah.
You can feel it, because you can see in when you deliver a memorable experience in a Legoland, you see the children, you know, all excited. You see,
or families, even the adults,
families, you know, friends, you know, going on, you know, in a theme park on a roller coaster and having, you know, a fantastic experience. You know, you can really feel it. That is, you know, in hotels, you know, the delivering a customer experience, you know, seeing a guest coming back over and over again. I've always loved that, you know, connection with the customers, and that kind of, you know, and that's why hospitality, I've always gravitated around hospitality. That's why I stayed for long, as long as I did with Hilton, but also with Merlin. And that's why I'm still involved with hospitality, travel and leisure, because you have that connection with customers. And who doesn't want, especially now that we are all, you know, under lockdown, stuck at home, who doesn't want to go back to a restaurant? I can't wait to go back and, you know, spend, you know, an evening with a family and friends. So who doesn't want to travel and be looked after on a plane or in a hotel or just going on holiday, or even if it's, you know, about seeing family? I've always loved that sense of the buzz that this industry has given me and continues to give me. So it's very sad now to just see the impact of the pandemic on so many people in our industry who have been who have been furloughed for so long, who have lost their jobs and are struggling to find another role in this kind of tough environment. But it's an industry that will come back, you know, because you know we're all waiting for, you know, as soon as we're allowed to reopen, is the first thing I'm going to do. I'm just going to book a nice, you know, table in my favorite restaurant. So I've always loved that connection with the customer and seeing the impact of what you do as a brand on the customer and see that kind of response. So it's quite something. It's quite unique for me, and it's quite exciting to be part of that environment.
Yeah. How did you then kind of take that, you know, you started raising money for charity and the Prince's Trust you mentioned and that kind of thing, and how did diversity become so important to you, or was it something that you always felt?
Look, I've always felt it. I would say on two grounds. One, the first one has been being a woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my story with my dad, you know, started like that. You know, that's not right. It's too much for a woman. I had to prove him wrong. And I had to make him proud, as I said. But I remember, you know, in all of my first job, you know, in the law firm, all the partners were men. And they thought I was quite exotic, you know, being Italian. I never thought of it, you know, being Italian was quite exotic, but I still remember being given that label. So I have always been in a situation where I was in the minority group, either because of my gender or because of the way I look and the way I sound, because of my accents, because of my culture. I've always been the only woman on the board, on a board of a number of companies, or one of two. So I really do know what it means to feel the underrepresented group. I know how it feels not to have a voice, mm-hmm. or to really struggle to have your voice heard. I'll share another little story with you, which might make you smile. In my first, you know, few weeks in my role as, you know, the most junior associate lawyer in the law firm in Brussels, I was invited to a meeting. There were 15 Japanese clients, and I sat next to the senior partner. He had asked me to go there. You cannot imagine how proud I was of having been invited, being, you know, 25, to a meeting with all of these, you know, very important clients. And then the senior partner looked at me and said, "Can you go and get me a cup of tea?" And I didn't move. I sat there. I looked at him and I said, "You can go and get that yourself." And I said that in front of everybody. He looked at me. There was, you know, there's those situations like a bit like a movie. There was a kind of a silence in the room. All of the Japanese, they were all men. I was the only woman. I was the youngest. I was the one supposed to go and get a cup of tea for the senior partner. I didn't do it. Inside, I was dying that, you know, I just felt like I was going to disappear. and kind of be swallowed into the, into earth. But I didn't. The conversation went on, and guess what? He never, ever asked me again to go and make him a cup of tea. So I've always had this thing about, I didn't go to university. I didn't, I wasn't admitted to the bar. I didn't become, a lawyer. I didn't want a scholarship to come and make here, a cup of tea to a, a bloke just because of, he's a senior partner. That's not why I'm here. I'm here because I'm a lawyer. And so, so I do know what it means to be put in a very difficult situation. And so I've always had it inside me that, that awareness of how it feels. I've always looked back to see, are there other women behind me? And do I need to put the ladder down so they can come up and be with me, as opposed to pulling the ladder up and not letting them come with me? So when I left Merlin, I very much felt a sense of duty and responsibility to use my position, to use my connections, to use my drive, to use my determination to make a difference to other women and the people from underrepresented group across my industry, hospitality, travel and leisure, so that everybody can go as far as they wish to go or as far as their talent allows them to go. So that's where it comes from.
And you do have, you talk about a remit in your bio of ways to help women and people of diversity. Can you just elaborate a bit more there in terms of, again, you've got a plethora of skills here, but your mentoring and coaching side. Can you just explain to the listeners a little bit about that, about some of the learnings that we should all take?
So I've had some great mentors myself. I mentor a lot of people. And I think it's really important that women and men share their learnings, share their experience, and support others who are on their way up. I currently mentor an exceptional young lady who happens to be a lawyer in a very well-known international restaurant chain. And she's actually my mentor because, we are in a reverse mentoring relationship where she is my mentor and I am her mentee. So we are doing kind of the reverse mentoring. And it's an absolute delight and pleasure to have conversations with her where she helps me think from an ethnic minority background perspective. And I help her think in terms of, what I have done, my lessons, my mistakes along the way, trying to help her see things that I have experienced before she experienced. It's a little bit what I wish I knew. That's very much that, if I knew that when I was your age, I wouldn't be working as hard as you do. just slow down a little bit, think about yourself, put yourself first, don't just always think about others and doing what's right for the business, and make sure that you don't lose track of your emotional stability and your well-being. So I think it's exceptionally powerful, and it's exceptionally powerful as well in terms of younger women in particular, seeing that there are women who come from a very normal background like I do, who got to have a very rewarding and fulfilling and successful career. It is possible. So mentoring is exceptionally powerful to help others along the way.
And then building on that, what sort of advice, coaching, or feedback would you give to people like Simon and I who would want to be supportive, but there's a difference between, I guess my own bias, is that being supportive is not enough. you know, because supportive and quiet doesn't really help. And I wonder if, is there something that we can learn that you wish we knew, people like us knew, to be more supportive and of women and people of color?
Look, I think what I always say is I think you need to be open to learn. I think you need to be aware of the challenges that people from underrepresented groups face. It's too easy in my mind to say, I'm not racist, I am not sexist. Actually, for me, the difference is when you are anti-racist. It's when you are anti-sexist. It's when you speak up, when you choose to challenge. In my story about, you know, go and get a cup of tea, nobody said, like, why are you asking her? Why can you not go yourself? I had to find the strength in myself, and it took a huge amount of willpower and confidence, which I didn't know I had. Somehow I found in myself to do that. But actually, when you see inappropriate behavior, when you see banter, when you see people making jokes that are directed or to people from an underrepresented group, actually you have to challenge. You just need to know how it feels to be at the receiving end of sexist behavior or sexist comments or racist comments or comments on your religion or comments on your ability or disability. We all have a responsibility to step up, and we all have a choice, and our choice is to go and challenge unacceptable behavior.
And just building on that, to your first question, you know, you chair and you're the founder of Women in Hospitality, Travel and Leisure. I'm interested, first of all, is there a particular dimension that's unique or different in the companies that you've worked for in that particular sector? And secondly, you know, how do you think it is today than it was 20 odd years ago when you were asked to make a cup of tea? Do you think things have got better, sir?
So what are the peculiarities of in hospitality, travel and leisure? Looking at, we have already a lot of diversity in hospitality, travel and leisure at junior level, at entry level. Where we need to get better at is making sure that that diversity stays with us throughout the, you know, the different levels in the business, and that we don't lose that as people step up to become, you know, middle management level and above. Because that's where we tend to lose women. We don't have a problem in attracting. Most of our companies have 60-70% female representation across the whole business. But then where we lose women is when they get married, when they have the first child, when they have the second child. That's when the flexibility is not there. That's where the support is not there. And that's where, you know, you can't anymore do the job that you used to do because you haven't got the support at home. You can't afford the childcare. So that's where as businesses, you know, that's what businesses can do to make sure that we don't lose that talent at that level. The issues around race and ethnicity are much more complex than that because, you know, you have the issue of intersectionality. If you are a woman and if you are a woman of color, you've got the double penalty. And that's much more difficult. And we've got, you know, there the issue is about raising awareness of bias, conscious and unconscious. It's about dealing with that. It's, as I said, you know, it's becoming inclusive leaders. A lot of leaders don't know how to be inclusive. They don't want to say the wrong thing, they use the wrong language, offend somebody. So we need to give, we have a responsibility to educate ourselves. So I think there is a lot that we need to do in terms of education and awareness at individual level as well as organization level. And sorry, the second question was, I just lost.
Yeah, I mean, put yourself 20 odd years ago, you were asked to make a cup of tea.
Yes.
And now, yes.
Look,
has there been progress?
Yes, we have made progress. In particular, over the last 10 years, we've made a huge amount of progress. There are more women on boards, more women on executive boards than ever before. But if you think it's taken us 10 years to achieve 30%, 10 years, and this is on listed businesses. What about all the businesses that are not listed in this country? So so there is still a long way to go. But, you know, we are in a good place. And for me, the most important thing that companies can do, they can be on the journey. You know, that's the important thing. Whether, you know, I don't expect every company to be best in class, but I do hope that companies come and join the conversation and are, you know, talking about it, and they are, and more are, they're talking about how can they create diverse and inclusive environments. I think, you know, when I hear lots of people say, we've done the gender thing, we haven't done the gender thing. There is still so much that we need to do to achieve a level playing field where everybody can, you know, aspire to go as far as they wish to go. But I do recognize there is a huge amount of work that we need to do in terms of the ethnic minorities, in terms of the Black and Asian ethnic minority groups, that, you know, there is a massive work that we need to do. The good thing is there are some companies that are leading the way, and I am absolutely, you know, humbled and privileged to be supported by companies that absolutely get it and want to make a difference, and they are committed to making a difference, and they're there to listen and learn and act. So that's fantastic to see when you surround yourself with companies that are like that.
So tell us, you have some, you know, an incredibly inspiring and audacious goal with your organization. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that you will do that?
So so it all started kind of little, you know, step by step. And it was, I remember having this kind of goal of having a group of, you know, 5-10 companies that would support the whole idea of this collaboration community. And now we have, you know, some amazing brands from McDonald's to Intercontinental Hotels to Compass, EasyJet, Virgin Atlantic, Pizza Express, Pizza Hut, Nando's, you know, just all the kind of the restaurant chains that we are all familiar with. And we have an incredible reach. We reach 2.1 million employees with the companies are involved in the collaboration community that we have created under WHTL. So the goal is to get to 5 million by 2025 globally. And I'm speaking to a number of very, very large employers that will allow me to get a bit closer to that goal. Hopefully, fingers crossed, still this year we will make a big step up in that direction. And what is the kind of the if you like, I mean, there is no secret, because I shout and share and talk about this to whoever wants to listen. Even if they don't want to listen, I talk about this all the time because I'm absolutely passionate about it. But it's all about collaboration. So it's all about joining forces. I am a strong believer that no single company can make a big difference on their own. If we join forces, I mean, look at what we've done, 2.1 million employees are covered by what we do. I'll give you one example, which I absolutely love, a very practical example of how we are impacting change. We did a piece of research on the maternity and paternity leave benefits that companies in our sector provide to their employees. And the research highlighted that most companies in our industry provide the bare minimum, what is legally required, but that we're not best in class, that we don't go above and beyond, that we don't support working parents in our organizations, deal with the, you know, what is a beautiful event, you know, having children is a magical thing, but also the difficulties of juggling work with responsibilities of having young children. Anyway, I shared the results of the research with my advisory board, where I have a number of CEOs and chairs from a number of different companies. And a few meetings later, the CEO of Intercontinental Hotels Group, Keith Barr, came back and said that as a result of that piece of research, he instigated a review of their maternity and paternity leave policy and benefits and policies globally.
Wow.
Worldwide.
Wow.
That was because he heard me talk about how little we do in terms of supporting working parents. So it wasn't just in the UK. It wasn't just in one hotel. It was in all of their hundreds of thousands of hotels across all different continents in which IHG is present. That is what makes my day. And when I hear things like this, it makes my week, it makes my year. And it's through this coming together and sharing and learning from each other. And it is through, challenging people. So I never point the finger. I never say, you naughty people are doing all of this. I'm just saying, is this right? Is this what we should do? And then there are those who act and there are those who takes a bit longer. But, you know, if only one person, you know, if I do just one piece of research and it changes things in one company that affects hundreds of thousands of employees, I would have done a good job.
Yeah. One final question, dear, that we do ask is what I wish I didn't know. Can you tell us, you know, throughout your career, something you felt you didn't know or changed you?
Look, that's a very difficult question. I've been trying to think about who is it I didn't know and how to answer that. Whether I knew or I didn't know, I just think that I've got much more strength than I thought I would ever have. I thought I had when I was in my 20s and 30s and 40s. Perhaps that, again, that comes with experience and knowledge of the world and knowledge of people. And you build that up. I just wished I were more confident in my own abilities. I've spent, my life thinking about I wasn't good enough or I could do better or I didn't do that very well, always kind of beating myself up. Until I discovered that I had never realized this. I went to a course and I discovered for the first time that we all have that kind of little voice in our head. For me, that little voice used to tell me, sometimes it does still, but used to tell me you are not good enough, or that wasn't very good, was it? Or that was a stupid thing that you just said, why did you do that? And I learned in this course to tell the little voice to shut up. Now I know that it's there. I recognize it straight away and I just said, just go away. I know I'm better than that. Don't question me. Don't make me feel I'm not good enough, because I am good enough.
Yeah.
So I wish I knew that in my 20s and in my 30s. And in my 40s, I'm in my 50s, I know about that. And I found out, just by going to a course where it was a revelation. So hopefully people listening in to this conversation, they will take that away, that, they are good enough. And if they've got the little voice that tells them they're not, just remind yourself, just realize when that comes into your head and just tell the little voice to go away.
That's fascinating, Tia, and I can vouch for that. I have voices in my head. I'm sure a lot of us do. You talked about that as a recent revelation. I think you described more about how you manage it, but definitely for me, you know, your ambition, your drive, linked with your, you know, I think you said earlier, somebody called you exotic, but I would say charm, you know, and in a really a positive way. That for me encompasses somebody like yourself, who we need lots more of in this world. So I just want to thank you for sharing so much experience and knowledge that you have. I'm desperate for the lockdowns to disappear, and I'd love to meet up in a restaurant and talk to you some more about your experiences. But thank you very much for appearing on our show this week.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, Mike and Simon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just, you know, one final comment. I mean, there's so much here, Taya, that I think people will be able to take away in terms of finding a path. You know, you talked about, you know, starting with, you know, as a flight attendant, and then you flipped into looking to become the Italian ambassador to Singapore, and then into law, and then you found your way. And I think so many people believe that very successful people like you know it all at the very beginning, and you set off on this great journey, and you know exactly where you're going to go and exactly how you're going to get there, and then you just do it. But the reality is it doesn't ever really work out quite that way, or at least it doesn't for many people. And yet, you know, there's so many ways to kind of measure success in life, and some people do it by money or title or whatever. But the most important one is by impact. And as I look back at your history and the, you know, the organizations that you led and that you're a part of, you know, impact was to me a central theme of what you've talked about. And now, you know, with the organization that you formed, the whole notion of touching the lives of 5 million people is audacious. But for you, you're on your way and you're doing it. And so it's just been incredibly inspiring to hear your story. And I'm so thankful that that our paths crossed.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.